The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
Ah, and it's a Wednesday. And here's the best description of where we are right now. Get ready to start streaming on YouTube. And, you know, I've got the chatters are starting to join us in the chat room. And the first post in the YouTube chat room today is from Pisces Bobby, who says, "Howdy, Nicole Sandler. It's been a very long week. Sigh. And it's only Wednesday." That's my addition to it. It is only Wednesday. And yes, it has been a long week, and it promises to get even longer. Here's the latest news, such as it is. There's not going to be any vote on the BIF on Thursday, because you heard Nancy Pelosi say it the other day, didn't you? Let me see. Here's what Nancy Pelosi just said the other day.
"Let me just say we're going to pass the bill this week.
Well,
but you know, I'm never bringing a bill to the floor that doesn't have the votes."
That's the important part. The first part, they're not going to pass it this week because they don't have the votes. So she will not bring it to the floor, even though originally the corporate Dems, we'll call them that for a while, the corporate Dems demanded it, a vote on Monday. Well, obviously that didn't happen, but they brought it to the floor to start the debate and whatever. So I guess that would satisfy them, thinking that the vote was actually going to be tomorrow, Thursday. And the fact is, it will not be, because the deal was made that the two bills, the BIF, or the Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework, that's what the BIF stands for. They never gave us a good name for it afterwards, so we're still stupidly calling it the BIF, as if that means anything. But that's the $1.2 trillion, that's the hard infrastructure bill. I wish they would come up with a simple name so I didn't have to spend, you know, the better part of a minute explaining what it is. And then there's the other one, the larger one, the $3.5 trillion over 10 years bill. And I always have to put in the over 10 years, because if not, it's misleading. And the one statistic, and they're supposed to be married together, and Nancy Pelosi tried to separate that, separate them and say, "Oh, it's okay, they'll still vote for it." No, they won't. The corporate Dems, if they pass the BIF now, when the new Build Back Better Act, which is the name for the larger reconciliation plan, when that comes up, they won't vote for it because the progressives have no leverage over them anymore. And again, this is not the progressives, you know, asking for something extraordinary. This is Joe Biden's agenda. And this was the deal that was made. So they're just trying to hold on to the deal. And so for the corporate mainstream media who's trying to vilify the progressives, we haven't had a song in a while, right? I got a little song for you. Feel free to sing along.
"I just need you to shut the fuck up, because nobody asked you, bitch. I need you to
shut the fuck up, bitch. Shut the fuck up, bitch.
Just shut the fuck up, bitch.
Shut the fuck up, bitch.
Bum, bum. Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up.
Bum, bum.
Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up.
You get it.
Bum, bum. Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up.
Bum, bum."
And that goes double for Kyrsten Sinema. So it's looking like, oh, Allison just walked in. You haven't heard my shut the fuck up song. This is, I'm going to play it again because Allison's here to hang with me during the show. And I just played this for all the idiots who are, there she is. Say hi. There she is. So this is the shut the fuck up song. You ready? You're going to like it.
"I just need you to shut the fuck up, because nobody asked you, bitch. I need you to shut the fuck up, bitch. Shut the fuck up, bitch. Just shut the fuck up, bitch. Shut the fuck up, bitch.
Bow, bow.
Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up.
Bow, bow.
Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up.
Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up.
Isn't it great? Okay, so that's it. And so I occasionally play it for people who need to just shut the fuck up. Right. So anyway, that goes out to Kyrsten Sinema, who apparently it's looking like there may be some movement with Joe Manchin, but not with Kyrsten Sinema. She's back at the White House today after being there three times yesterday. I don't know. Somebody who's got some sway over her needs to do something. In fact, you know, I tried to raise Keith Olbermann from the land of the, you know, Twitter lives, because that's the only place I see him anymore. I kind of blame him because it was back, what, it's got to be 12 years ago or longer. He's the one who elevated her when she was a state representative in Arizona. She used to go on Countdown with Keith Olbermann on MSNBC, and he elevated her profile. So, Keith, I would like you to weigh in on Kyrsten Sinema today. Anyway, I digress. I hope you got to hear former Florida Governor Charlie Crist yesterday. It was a pretty enlightening interview. If you missed it, you can always go to the website, NicoleSandler.com/9-28-21. That's yesterday's date. That's where it's posted. But I will be guest hosting the broadcast on Friday. And what I'm going to do is put together a special show that's the interview with Charlie Crist and the interview with Nikki Fried. Yes? Olbermann is apropos.
Because Sinema is the worst person in the world.
Because Sinema is the worst person in the world. That deserves a ding. There you go. All right. So I told you yesterday that today's show is pretty much on tape. I tape interviews only when the person is, the interview subject is not available to do it live. So I wanted to speak with Zach Carter. In case you don't know who Zach Carter is, you probably do. He wrote for Huffington Post for years and years and years. He was one of the best people they had over there. Huffington Post was recently acquired by BuzzFeed. And they did some good stuff and they did some bad stuff. The good is they improved the content of Huffington Post because, you know, it needed some improvement. So the quality of the reporting is better, but they also laid off, they cut down the staff and they got rid of a lot of really good people, including Zachary Carter. But Zach Carter has a book out. He just launched a Substack newsletter and he's still writing. In fact, the reason I invited him on the show today, we taped it yesterday, is because of an op-ed that appeared in the New York Times. But he couldn't come on live today, so we taped it yesterday, but it's still all timely and topical, and it makes good sense. And we did talk for a while. So with no further ado, I am going to hit that interview. Zach Carter is a journalist who's launched his own Substack newsletter. Welcome to the... I haven't done that, but you're in a growing segment of the population there. You can subscribe at zacharydcarter.substack.com. I'll post a link on the blog where I post the show. And his book, The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes, is now out in paperback. And I haven't even spoken to you about this book, and I feel very remiss in not doing that. So hopefully we'll hit on a lot of all that today. So welcome back to the show, Zach. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Nicole.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, the reason I reached out to you right now is because of an op-ed that you published in the New York Times. It's actually adapted from the book, and you expanded on it, I guess, in your Substack newsletter. The title, the headline they put on it is, "Why Are Moderates Trying to Blow Up Biden's Centrist Economic Plan?" And first, before we get into the meat of it, I've got to ask you about your definition of moderates and centrists, because I have a real problem with both of those words.
I think there is a difference between centrism and moderatism.
Yeah.
I tend to use centrist to be someone who is trying to navigate between two other ideas. A moderate is somebody who is maybe more committed to an underlying set of principles. polls, but they, I don't know. It's tricky. They both are defined a little bit by things outside themselves.
Right. Now, do you consider Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema a centrist or a moderate? Because I don't consider them either one.
The trick with a word like moderate is that I think we're talking about usually more tactics with moderatism rather than maybe an ideological position or a deep commitment to a particular policy idea or agenda, but a lack of willingness to say, you know, go to extreme, to take extreme measures in order to pursue a particular path. So I think in the case of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, I mean, where they're taking fairly extensive, going to fairly extensive, at least procedural measures to interrupt the Biden agenda, I don't think that's the sort of thing that someone who thinks of themselves as a moderate would typically do. But within the zeitgeist of DC political journalism, people who just openly express discomfort, contempt, disapproval for the left,
or even for Democratic Party leadership,
often end up with these these types of monikers. And I think for the sake of the debate over over President Biden's agenda, I mean, these people are being classified as moderates and centrists.
I know, and it bothers me. But by the same token, you know, they'll call Liz Cheney or Adam Kinzinger moderate because in this case they're bucking their party. I don't think they're moderates either. I don't think we have moderates, and I don't think we have many centrists. You know, I call them conservadems, talking about Manchin and Sinema and the handful in the House who are holding up the process here. I think our mutual friend Howie Klein calls them the Republican wing of the Democratic Party, which, you know, also works. It's like fingernails on a blackboard to me when I hear them described as moderates. It's Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, in my book, are not moderate. They're radical. So anyway, it's just a thing with me. But I got a kick out of the fact that both of those are in the headline of your New York Times piece. But more importantly is the substance of what you're getting at. You say that Biden's economic plan, the Build Back Better plan, you know, the thing that the media insists on calling a $3.5 trillion boondoggle. It's, you know, they're talking about it like this is money we've never seen spent before. But again, before we get into the meat of your piece, the military, the NDAA that just passed the House is for $740 billion. In 1 year. So we're talking about not even a half of a tenth of that in a year, right? We're talking about if it's a $3.5 trillion bill, that would be $3.5 billion a year over 10 years. Less than half of what we're giving to the military with no strings attached, no questions asked, and nobody saying, how are you going to pay for that?
You know, I think there's a sort of fear of large numbers in D.C. That develops whenever anything is moving legislatively of of social significance. The fear of large numbers doesn't exist at other times. The large numbers will be flying around and senators and members of Congress seem perfectly comfortable with them. It's when the large numbers are associated with change in some respect. And I think this idea of change and stability while we're interrogating the definitions of words here is often a little bit illusory. I mean, you mentioned the NDAA there, you know, it's true that the United States has been giving, has had a very large military budget for a long time. And it's also true that it tends to keep growing. And so that's what, in a sense, that's a stable arrangement. But the money that goes off to the military doesn't just preserve the status quo. It goes into all sorts of things that are changing. I mean, the U.S. mission in Afghanistan no longer exists, for instance, but it changed very significantly over the course of 20 years. And we weren't really talking about the way that mission had changed. The money was just going out the door, and it seemed like a normal thing that was happening in Washington. Oh, we always pay for what's happening in Afghanistan. But what was happening in Afghanistan was, in fact, changing. And it was changing without a whole lot of congressional oversight or input. So I think the number stuff, you know, it's obviously there, and the discrepancy is always in favor of war and the wealthy against anything representing a sort of intuitive broad public interest. But aside from that, there's a general sort of misunderstanding, I think, in Washington right now about even how the world works. There's a sense that things don't that the world is a stable and predictable place, and that if Washington just leaves it alone, things are going to work out for the best, or better than they would if Washington started taking action. But the fact is, it's not just, you know, aside from Washington, the government is always taking action. The world is always changing. We're always responding to problems. And I think there's something really troubling about there being a dominant ideology, even within the Democratic Party, suggesting that public action and the use of public power is somehow this risky, dirty thing. We're always exercising public power, not always well, but the question is how we should choose to use it. And what has bothered me most about the debate over the Build Back Better plan is that we've had months of debate over this without any debate over the actual social programs and policies themselves. There is no economic argument that has been launched by Biden's critics in his own party against this bill. All they've talked about is the size of the bill. And I think that's a distraction. You know, we've been talking about trillions of dollars still seems large to most people. Right. And I think before COVID, the idea of a $1 trillion relief bill seemed a little bit wild and crazy. You know, in the Obama years, at the very beginning of his presidency, there was a debate over how large the stimulus should be. And for political reasons, they just rejected any number over $1 trillion. It just sounded too crazy. It had nothing to do with what, you know, the economy needed or where there were shortfalls in demand or what sort of jobs we needed. It was just, oh, well, a number will probably scare people. I don't think trillion, the word, is quite as frightening anymore. But, you know, it's also the case that even within the number debate, numbers don't mean today what they meant in 2009. The U.S. economy is much larger than it was in 2009. Right. So there is a sense in which a $3.5 trillion bill is one of the largest in history by dollar amount. But relative to the size of the U.S. economy, I mean, we're talking about, you know, something that is larger than what the Obama administration contemplated in 2009. But not radically larger, not over the course of 10 years. I mean,
right. Well, that's the point. It's over 10 years. And I think all the pearl clutching about the $3.5 trillion is a bit disingenuous. When you break it down, the annual cost, again, is less than half of what we spend on the military. And again, I would think our expenses in Afghanistan are going to be cut substantially because we're not there anymore. What's happening with that extra money and why the increase in the funding? But something like $24 billion more than Biden asked for.
Yeah, it's just very clear that there are certain interests that don't seem to count when certain lawmakers in Washington are considering public policies. That money doesn't count. It's fun and free, and it does something that those lawmakers consider useful, whether the judgment is accurate or not. It depends on the funding. But you can see they're exercising judgment there, even when I think a lot of lawmakers talk themselves into believing that they're not, that this is just, they're just sort of making sure that the ship continues to stay afloat, but they're not, you know, they're not directing it. They're not providing the wind behind the sails. The boat's just not sinking. But if you start talking about, you know, a childcare program, well, then, you know, we're doing something a little bit more active. That feels like asserting our will. And that, I think there are a lot of lawmakers who are just genuinely afraid of that. They don't present themselves as if they are afraid of it, but they basically defer to experts and to lobbyists because they're afraid of their own judgment, and they don't really know how voters are going to respond to changes. I mean, we have a pretty sophisticated polling industry in the United States, but polling can't predict the future. It can't predict what people are going to think in 2 months or 2 years about a program. One of the odder things about the Affordable Care Act is that it became more popular over time as it was implemented. And also whittled away. So, you know, is there a true American sense of the value of the Affordable Care Act that that sustains itself over time, some sort of deep kernel of belief that's just anchored within every person? No, the perception of these things changes, and we don't really know what the world is going to look like when it comes time for voters to vote on these things. But that said, no one's talking about what is in the actual proposal.
Not at all. I agree. So let's do that, shall we? I mean, you talked about this as a centrist economic plan, and actually I think it is. We are so far behind the rest of the world in terms of I hate to use the term, but a social safety net, taking care of your citizens from, you know, from birth to death. And we've got a lot of big gaps in there. This would fill in some of those holes. So, but you're right. No, I see a lot of, again, pearl clutching in the corporate media about the dollar amount, but very little discussion of what this bill would accomplish, other than they say it's so encompassing. It's, you know, child care and health care and elder care and what else is in there that falls under the centrist economic plan you describe?
Well, I defined the program as a centrist program because I think even though it is a rather ambitious program in a lot of respects, we're talking about an effort to use economic support, economic relief to address the crisis of democracy that the United States faces. Nobody's under any illusions about what this bill is designed to do. This is Joe Biden's legacy. Whether or not this bill passes will define his presidency. Right. This is his big shot at saying, here's why I was president and what it was for. And he's a president who took office much the way Franklin Delano Roosevelt did in this flood of crises, the January 6th riot on Capitol Hill. We have widening inequality that seems to have been inequality has been expanding at an inexorable rate for more than 30 years, but it accelerated during the pandemic. And we have all sorts of international crises as well. There's been a lot of attention paid to Afghanistan, but the U.S. relationship with China and the U.S. relationship with Europe is, both of those are under a lot of strain right now. And this package, it's billed as an economic package and as social spending and all the rest, but it's also an attempt to rebuild and reframe the American economy as a green manufacturing economy, right, which is part of a diplomatic reset with Europe and China. So there's a diplomatic component to this, which I think is going overlooked, but it's a very centrist kind of diplomatic approach. It's an approach that's about asserting American power and having more leverage in negotiations with our allies even. So that's not like some sort of radical left critique of the American empire. We're talking about having a more robust American diplomatic presence with this bill. We're also taking several measures that should work to tamp down on inflation over the next few years. That is a boring word that economists use all the time. But we've seen in the pandemic, a lot of supply chains have been disrupted. And when you can't get a key part from somewhere, the actual good can't be manufactured. And then the price of that good goes up because there just isn't enough of it to go around. So people are willing to pay more to get their hands on what exists. So we saw, for instance, the price of used cars went way, way up this year. The price of housing has also gone up substantially over the course of this year. That's also pandemic related. It's not like, the U.S. has had housing problems for a very long time, but the fact that I think we had a sharp problem this year with housing suggests some changes in the pattern of, who's buying houses, who is moving, who is renting, and also the availability of just materials to build houses. The price of lumber went totally crazy right for a few months this year, and home building kind of went on a pause for a while. So there's a lot of stuff that's happening still with the pandemic, but we don't really know how long the pandemic stuff is going to last. I mean, I think each of these price increases are kind of transitory issues that will last for, 3 to 6 months and then be resolved. But with the Delta variant going wild, we don't know what other variants are coming down the pike. We could be in a transition period for quite some time. So taking action to expand the ability of the United States to actually produce things is one way to fight inflation long term. one way to do that is to make sure that people can actually get into the workforce. A key constraint on supply in the United States is a lack of workers, particularly coming out of the pandemic. You've heard talk about worker shortages in different places. And that's not all just employers whining, although a lot of it is. There really is a sort of mismatch in certain key industries over pay and also over work conditions and whether people want to be in these industries. So a lot of stuff is reshuffling. And that means if you want workers, you have to have people who are able to work. So the childcare program that the Biden administration is pursuing with this is really important. It not only is designed to create an actual viable market for childcare in the United States. There's all sorts of problems with childcare. If you have children, you know it's ridiculously expensive. Mm-hmm. But the whole point there is not just to help you with your kids, although that's very nice. It is also to help you go to work if you want to go to work. If that's the thing you want to do to go out and be in the world, that's easier to do. I have a 2-year-old. I dropped her off this morning. I will be picking her up this afternoon. It's hectic to work and have kids at the same time.
Yep.
But I can do that because I can afford the childcare that is in the neighborhood down the street. If I can't afford that childcare, I have to take care of the child, right?
That's right.
So now I don't think the supply of economic commentary is in particularly, dire straits right now. So I don't think that's an example of an inflationary check on the economy. But, if you're trying to build more cars, for instance, because there aren't enough cars out there to meet consumer demand, then you need people to work in the factories.
And
people can't work in the factories if they have to be home with the kids. So it's an indirect way of raising wages and getting people back to work while also controlling inflation. For the childcare stuff, though, just the part of it that just matters for your home, this industry is totally screwy because there's a cap on what people can afford to pay for childcare, which is what they make at work, right? So that means that wages in childcare are just inherently low. And when wages are low, that means it is a waste of time to get an expensive education in this industry. And so it's very difficult to find people who are good at providing childcare at low pay.
That's right.
Just as it is in any industry.
Of course.
It's really, really hard.
As it should be, actually. Right?
That's bad.
Yes.
So this bill, one of the reasons the bill is expensive is because making childcare an actually livable profession with a living wage costs money. Right now, we do not pay enough for quality childcare because the wages outside of childcare are too low.
Right.
So this bill is providing money to specifically fix the childcare issue, but it will also probably be good for wages in general because of all the other stuff that is in the legislation, help with housing. It's a very, which also another inflationary category. The broad point is, a new childcare benefit is a liberal priority, right? Progressives like the idea of more social benefits. But it is a liberal priority that's being deployed for the sake of this broader economic agenda, which is essentially a fight between the far right and the far left over the future of the country. If you were a centrist in the 1930s or the 1940s, you had a set of policy goals that were attached to being a centrist. There's a historian named Arthur M. Schlesinger Jr., who's a very, very prominent historian in the first half of the 20th century, the middle sort of decades of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But he wrote a book in 1949 called The Vital Center. And he was talking about the New Deal, about the Roosevelt administration as occupying an intellectual, ideological space between communism on the left and fascism on the right. He's a non-authoritarian democratic middle. We're in that same kind of era today. We have authoritarian politics in the United States.
Yes.
And a sane centrist wants to use, and a sane moderate wants to use, would want to use economic policy and the traditional institutional tools of American government to advance an agenda that would tamp down on those more extremist ideologies. I won't say flat out extremist because there are people on the left and to some extent even on the right who don't favor overthrowing the government, but favor more aggressive tactics than what Biden is pursuing with this legislation.
Without a doubt, yeah.
And now Biden doesn't answer to the right. He was elected as a Democrat. So he has a Democratic Party coalition to hold together. And if you look at what the demands from the sort of more moderate progressives in the United States have been, he doesn't seem to be really paying much attention to those demands. I mean, we in the 2020 primary, all the big ideas were around Medicare for all, around a tax on wealth, decriminalizing border crossings. At certain points, cutting funding for the police departments.
Right, the ideas that came from Bernie Sanders and to some extent Elizabeth Warren.
Yes, and also, I mean, even Julian Castro decriminalizing border crossings.
Right.
Those ideas are all completely ignored in this package. Biden's even ignoring his own campaign promise to provide a public option for healthcare.
Yeah,
okay, there's just like more money for Medicare in this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the left has already flushed all of its dreams down the toilet in this bill. And you don't really see the left complaining a whole lot about the process. They've been very quiet. The people who were loudly complaining are people who describe themselves as centrists, but they don't have a centrist policy agenda. They have no policy agenda. What they have is a general sort of amorphous sphere of change. And I think a misguided political sense that if they draw distinctions between themselves and a Democratic president, they'll be rewarded by this, by voters at the polls who will see this activity as moderate and centrist and sensible and careful. When in fact, it's really quite a reckless thing to do. And it's nakedly obstructionist at this point. But it's reckless insofar as, you know, the challenges the country faces are challenges that we were talking about the viability of American democracy here. This is Biden's shot. This is the plan that he's going for to save American democracy.
Right.
And if you think that $3.5 trillion is too much to pay to save democracy, you're not talking about centrism. You're talking about people who don't understand what money is for.
Right. And the other part of it, though, is, you know, you're very capably explaining why this is a centrist policy, why this is not the progressive pipe dream, but the media is you know, pushing it out as that progressive pipe dream to the point where, like, Stephen King tweets out, I think this was yesterday, memo to progressives, 70% of something is better than 100% of nothing. The electorate is watching you squabble like children in the playground. Really? Was that necessary? I mean, Stephen King is a reliable voice on the left, but this is not helpful. And then this morning, I'm sort of getting into it with one of my regular listeners. This is a woman who's been with me for a long, long time. And she's like, Manu Raju tweeted, AOC walking into Dem caucus meeting says she's a no on the infrastructure vote on Thursday, quote, unless I get some new information. And she retweeted that with the comment, of course. And I wrote back, I said, good for her. I'm sorry you're cheering on not getting what we need to make this country equitable for most people. Keep it a shithole. That's, you know, that's the ticket. But that's the point. It's like this push on saying you can't have nice things, because if you do, we're going to call that radical.
There's a sort of tradition in Washington under the last couple of Democratic presidents,
uh-huh,
where people assume that liberal Democrats, progressive Democrats are asking for things that are unrealistic because the president is not where they are, right? Bill Clinton was not a progressive president.
Nor was Barack Obama,
right?
No, he was not.
Barack Obama was a proud new Democrat, there's a lot of good things the Obama administration did, but I would not classify him as, you know, a soldier
close
from the progressive movement.
Right.
So there, when the Democratic Party would negotiate with itself on these issues, it was usually some sort of arrangement between centrists and the Democratic Party and Republicans that progressives were trying to in some way adjust, you know, give it some little extra something to make it feel a little bit more lefty, and they're going to vote yes, and they would fight over this. And typically the stakes of that were not terribly high. So even seeing, you know, trying to get a public option into Obamacare, trying to raise the or to lower the age of eligibility for Medicare. These are things that people wanted to do. But when they were cut out of the Affordable Care Act negotiations, pretty much everybody involved was like, well, the heart of the bill was this, these exchanges anyway. We're going to try to create a new individual market for health insurance. Yeah. That's the real big fish here. So we're just going to vote for this. And so it does look like squabbling to people who don't follow it closely when you see progressives asking for things that ultimately don't matter very much because they vote for the bill anyway. This is not what's happening right now on this bill. The progressives have said they're willing to vote for the entire Joe Biden package. They want is to vote for all of it. The people
and
who
that
are
was
the
deal that was made. That was the deal that was presented to them. All right, you hold on. We'll do them together and we'll vote. And so because they're trying to stick to, as you call it, the original deal, I think you said that, they're being slammed as being radical again.
Yes, and the well, I mean, it depends on which media you read. I mean, I think there are several mainstream, mainstream media publication pundits and thinkers who have correctly noted that the people raising a fuss here are the people squabbling and crying about not getting everything they want are the Joe Manchins and the Kyrsten Sinemas. And what's been particularly tricky with Manchin and Sinema is that they keep changing what it is they say they have a problem with. There'll be one round of talks, they'll get to where they want to be, and then they'll have another round of talks. There's a lot of reporting on Sinema's own office that within her own inner sphere, nobody knows what she actually wants to get out of the negotiations. So some of that stuff is just lawmakers not being good at being lawmakers. Mm-hmm. That's just being a bad senator. That's not ideological. And I think that's reflected in the fact that these guys are attacking legislation. I mean, Joe Biden's a career centrist.
Of course he is.
Everybody knows he was the moderate guy in 2020.
Always.
His whole deal was that he wanted to turn the temperature down on American politics so people could get things get back to normal and we could do common sense things and solve common sense problems again. Okay. Paying for childcare is a really, having the government pay for childcare, help pay for childcare is a pretty common sense type of thing. You may not like it. It may not be a policy that you like, but it's not some crazy radical,
You know what? And the other thing, we're stressing the childcare part of it, but that's just one part of it. Another large part that can't be ignored is climate change. Finally, we're going to do something to deal with climate change. And that's not addressed in what's called the BIF. And again, the Democrats suck at messaging. Really, they can't come up with a better name for the hard infrastructure bill? It's astounding. They're still calling it the BIF and the reconciliation plan.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the hard infrastructure bill they're talking about is basically an elaborate highway bill. I mean, there's stuff in there that I think is fine. But it's you're not going to make a down payment on fixing climate change with a highway bill.
It doesn't address it.
But I will say, one area where I wish that this package was stronger is on climate. There apparently have been some issues with getting climate friendly language through the reconciliation process.
That's Joe Manchin again, isn't it?
Just Joe Manchin, yes, but also literally just the whether or not it fits legally under the rubric of reconciliation and the negotiations with the parliamentarian and all of this other crap. It could be a much greener package than it is. And I think it would cost more money to be a more serious environmental overhaul kind of package. But it is kind of our last chance to at least make a down payment on tackling climate change. If you don't pass this bill, the alternative is not, oh, we'll really fix it in 6 months. The alternative is the planet burns.
That's right.
So you have to pass this bill if you're serious about climate change. It will not fix climate change on its own. It won't come close.
No, but it's a step in the right direction. It's at least movement where we haven't had any.
Yes, yes. And creates, there's a bunch of stuff on even just like electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. So far, where if you can electrify the car fleet in the United States, you do a lot for reducing emissions. It's not a cure-all, but it is really a pretty significant change. And it's a problem for, here again, we have like the center fighting the left. There are urbanists who want to get rid of cars, right? we're talking about electrifying cars. Okay, so the United States will still be dependent on car culture and car manufacturers, and everybody will still get to do all their sales. They'll just be for different kinds of cars. It's very much a reform within the existing social and economic structure. It's just the cars are going to be different. If you get a lot of the fleet electrified, I mean, that really helps you. That makes it easier to meet your climate goals.
Right. But then again, electric cars still are powered by electricity, which is still powered by either coal-powered power plants or natural gas. I mean, there's still, again, we do away with the combustion engine, which I guess is a good thing, but there's still an issue there. We're still not adding to the crap in the atmosphere that's warming the planet.
Right. You don't go to zero.
Right. Exactly.
But turning it down a lot, I think, is right. Meaningful.
I agree.
Meaningful reform.
Zachary Carter is with us. I want to ask you about, you know, your book deals with economics. And I've said this many times. The one thing I know about money is I'm good at spending it. Economy, I'm not great on. Right. And I can do that very well. I'm just not good with the other things. Now, Stephanie Kelton has been a regular guest on this program. And so I have a basic understanding of modern monetary theory. I get it, because she can explain it in a way that even I can understand. And but so you write about John Maynard Keynes in the book, The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. Keynesian economics was the thing. What is the difference between Keynesian economics and modern monetary theory?
It depends on who you talk to. You know, I'm always reluctant to speak on behalf of the entire MMT community.
Sure.
Because while I'm very close with and, you know, have just tons of respect for, you know, Stephanie Kelton, Nathan Tankis, Rohan Gray, people like sort of the big MMT folks, you know, there are a lot of people who say MMT is one thing and others who say it's another. There are people in MMT who don't like it to be affiliated with Keynes. I'm a Keynes, a Keynes scholar, and I studied Keynesian economics. I see MMT and what Stephanie Kelton and Nathan Tankis have been detailing and delineating over the last decade or so as a branch of Keynesian thought.
Right, that's how I see it. Right,
and you know, a particularly fruitful branch of Keynesian thought. The trouble with Keynes is he's one of these figures whose ideas are very, very useful. And so people in power have used those ideas and the ideas of them become associated with the people in power who use them in a particular way. And so when I think most of us think about John Maynard Keynes, we think about the economy of the 50s and 60s, the idea that when the economy hits a rough patch, the government spends money.
Yes.
and pulls it out, and then the market takes over and we get back to normal. Mm. I think Keynesian thought is a much more complex philosophical endeavor. I think Keynes as an economist is a much more sophisticated thinker than what is encouraged by most PhD programs in macroeconomics today. Certainly what is encouraged by the American political system for macroeconomists today. You know, he came of age at a time when the economics profession was still very young and not obviously distinct in many ways from philosophy departments or political theory departments. His friends when he was an undergraduate were people like Bertrand Russell and Ludwig Wittgenstein, who were philosophers, not economists. And his degree was not in economics. He studied math.
Wow.
At Cambridge.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he was not a formally trained economist until he was actually working on the job at Treasury, British Treasury during World War I. He'd taken some classes with at Cambridge, but he wasn't John Maynard Keynes, the great economist,
right.
Yet. So I think the MMT line about budget deficits is focusing on a particular aspect of Keynes's thought, in particular the role of money, the nature of money. Money as a tool of the state rather than as a market phenomenon, which I think is basically right, and which Keynes was, you know, certainly by the end of his life, a believer in. He never went around saying, I believe in modern monetary theory, because people hadn't branded it that way yet. And I think to some extent, the reason we have a thing called modern monetary theory is because the type of Keynesian economics that became very popular over the second half of the 20th century, became removed from a lot of these observations about money. They didn't seem central to the thought to people who were implementing the ideas. You know, a lot of times intellectuals kind of serve as a sort of post hoc kind of justification for what people in power want to do. They don't read a book and say, aha, it's all in here. Now let's go put the general theory of employment, interest, and money to work in American politics. Mm-hmm. They have a problem. They want to solve it. They read a book and it says, ah, this is okay. And then what they want to do is they've been given license by intellectuals somewhere. And I think Keynes served that function for much of the 20th century. And when people decided they didn't like where the economy and the country were headed under that direction, they said, well, not everything in this theory is bad. Let's look at the good stuff. And to be clear, you know, Keynesian tools are not just, you know, I'm not just referring to Democrats here. I'm talking about misuse of Keynesian economics. The Republican Party has always had a pretty robust Keynesian streak, even if it doesn't acknowledge it in its rhetoric. I mean, the spending we were talking about at the beginning of the show, spending big on the military, but not on social services, cutting taxes for the wealthy in the name of economic growth. These are Keynesian tools. Wow. They are. They can be used to pursue conservative social goals, or they can be used to pursue progressive social goals. And I think over the last decade or so, people like Stephanie and Nathan have done a great job sort of branding Keynesianism for progressive purposes as modern monetary theory. But when I talk to them about this, they get very, very technical and talk about Federal Reserve operations and want to make clear a host of distinctions that I got you.
That's where my eyes glaze over. Here's my question. So according to Stephanie, you know, when we need money, we can just print it. The government is the economy. They can do that. But so I look at the problem we're faced right now with the debt ceiling, which is just a ridiculous hurdle. When Congress approves spending, it should automatically have a provision saying, by the way, we will pay these bills when they come due. Right? And that would do away with the need to raise the debt ceiling. It's just, it's nonsensical and ridiculous. And now you got Mitch McConnell saying, Democrats are going to have to do that by themselves. You know, come on. But the question is, so this is saying we can't borrow more than this amount. Who are we borrowing from and why are we borrowing money from them?
Well, I think, you know, there's a handful of different questions sort of embedded in there. The debt ceiling, let's start with. I mean, the debt ceiling shouldn't exist.
Exactly, right?
It doesn't make sense. I mean, why should you have to have a second vote to say you really wanted to do what you already
did?
Right,
we did this. We approved it. Duh, you paid the bills.
Yes, it's just this weird artifact from a random compromise that was made over World War One spending.
Ridiculous.
You know, the United States suddenly spent a lot more money than it had historically when it entered World War One, and so some weird things happened with lawmakers who didn't really know what they were doing or think through what they were doing. And 100 years later, we have this thing. It didn't really matter until 2011. Let's be clear. No right. one really cared about this weird quirk, but it started to be used as a procedural weapon
by Republicans.
By the Republican Party. Right. Yeah. There had been, you know, grandstanding, silly things that Democrats had done over the debt ceiling in the past, but they hadn't really used it as a procedural weapon or as a serious tool for derailing a Republican agenda. They had used it to, you know, make a speech and get a photo op or something.
Right.
Not saying that activity is particularly admirable, but there is a distinction in these, these two types of,
right.
of behaviors. So it just shouldn't exist. There are a lot of ways to get rid of it. I mean, there's this silly thing with the Treasury being authorized to mint its own platinum coins.
Yes.
The Treasury could actually just mint a gazillion dollar platinum coin, put it on account with the Federal Reserve, and this debt ceiling stuff goes away forever.
Right.
Nobody ever spends the coin. There's no new money or something that makes it into the economy. It's just always authorized. The spending is always authorized. You don't have to go back to Congress and get it reauthorized. You could do the same thing functionally when you raise the debt ceiling by raising the debt ceiling to 100 gazillion bajillion dollars. It's different from abolishing the debt ceiling, but in practice, not really.
Right. It renders it not an issue. Just
yes.
there. Right.
And to an issue to become an issue in the future when perhaps people are less willing to, you know, blow up the entire global financial system right. over what? I mean, that's what's particularly odd about this, too. I mean, we talked earlier in the show about the way centrists in the Democratic Party haven't made policy objections to the Biden agenda. The Republican Party's criticisms have been pretty quiet, really. Mm-hmm. Republicans aren't saying they hate the Biden agenda and, oh, look what he's doing. They're just trying to make the Democrats like, own what it is. I guess I'm not sure that's a really good procedural tactic for Mitch McConnell, but you can see why he's turned to it, because the polling on the individual items within Build Back Better is really good. And in fact, the polling gets better when people find out that it costs more. Oh, they're going to spend more money on childcare? I like it more then. And people don't seem to really care about the debt or deficits so much post COVID. I mean, we've spent $5 trillion and the sky hasn't fallen.
Well, they didn't. They didn't until Joe Biden took office, right? When Trump was in, it wasn't an issue. You know, just look at the $2 trillion tax cuts. And by the way, the $7 trillion that he added to the debt is what raising this debt ceiling would cover. It doesn't cover what they're negotiating now or any future spending. Right? It's what we amassed in the last 4 years.
Right, right. I mean, the debt ceiling vote is totally superfluous and silly. Right. I think the public polling on debt and deficit stuff, it's much better today than it was 5 years ago, 6 years ago. People are just, they don't prioritize debt and deficits as a serious, as a top issue for them. The economy is an important issue for people, but there's not a sense that the national debt is going to, you know, destroy the country, which was a very, people were just walking around for a lot of the 90s and a lot of the early 2000s thinking that the national debt was going to destroy their children's lives. And it was completely wrong, right? It was just totally wrong. And it's still wrong. And the debt ceiling should not be something that you know we care about. So it would be nice. This is the third debt ceiling standoff, big one in my lifetime, and I'm not that old. So I feel like we should, whether Congress gets rid of it by just raising it to infinity, or whether Biden gets rid of it administratively by minting an infinity platinum coin. Either one of those solutions is fine with me, but we need to stop doing this. I mean, we know that the United States
enough
government
already.
Is not really right. efficient at solving problems, and there's just no reason to create a problem that's dangerous and have it lying around. If the U.S. default, the dollar and U.S. Treasury bonds are the heart of the international financial system. And so if the U.S. defaults on its debt, the entire system of credit that the whole world yes. operates on will be just thrown into all kinds of chaos. And there's just, you don't put bags of broken glass and rusty nails in the hands of toddlers, right? You know, you just don't make that a problem that you have to deal with. It's just time to get rid of it.
It's insane, right? And it's Mitch McConnell. Just, I don't know, creating problems just because he can, trying to, you know, it's an epidemic on the right. He's trying to own the libs, I guess. It doesn't make any sense. There's no reason for him to do this.
No, I don't. I don't think it makes a lot of sense. I also frankly, though, don't really see what the big deal is for Democrats. They spent a really long time trying to figure out how they're going to play this. And they basically have two plays. You can do it through reconciliation,
right.
or you can do it through the coin process. Just pick one and do it. And
right.
you did it.
Exactly. But it's the theatrics. It's the whole theatrics of it. And, you know, taking it down to the wire. Same thing with the continuing resolution. Look, we're going to shut down on Thursday if we don't come up with a spending. Well, do something, because we shouldn't even be messing around with that stuff. There are too many other big things on the line, right?
Well, right. And you know, we have the Build Back Better bill It's a really serious piece of legislation. It's not as progressive or robust as I wish that it were, but it's a really serious piece of legislation, which is designed to solve or to address very real problems. And the objections to it so far have been numbers,
right?
Pretty much.
Oh, I mean, it's so much money. Yeah.
And I mean, we also should be really clear that some of the objections, it's hard to believe that they've been raised in good faith. I mean, Joe Manchin wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal in early September saying that he wanted a strategic pause on these negotiations. Yes. And he said it was, you know, we have an overheating economy where inflation is attacking the wages of middle-class people, and it's irresponsible to pursue a $3.5 trillion bill at that time when crippling national debt is already ravaging our country. And, you know, the inflation stuff, I guess you do have to have sort of a background in economics to recognize that the economy is not overheating right now. And economists, you know, disagree about things sometimes. I'm sure that you can find some economists who say we are overheating and that's why we're having inflation. But it doesn't really seem to be consistent with the economic data. But the stuff on whether or not the bill raises the national debt is just, it's stupid. I mean, Biden is, the whole point of this program, that this $3.5 trillion bill, is that it's paid for.
That's right.
And I don't know why Biden wanted to put himself in that box, but he did. And for Joe Manchin to go out and say, you know, we have to worry about the debt when we pass legislation like this, is to suggest very strongly that we're running up the debt by another $3.5 trillion.
Right. Which is absurd.
Frankly, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. I don't think it would do anything.
Right. But that's not what's happening. And that's the bottom line. Zach
just
Carter,
what's happening.
Right. I've kept you, you know, much longer than I intended, but we could keep going. I know you've got somewhere to be, and we're going to get to the end of the hour here. So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, just because I come from a music background, you have another whole side to you.
Yes.
This is
my office.
Your office is also a studio. So, what's playing in the background is a band called Brutalism. Here, I've even got a little video. I love the video here. This is awesome. So I have to blame Howie Klein for alerting me to your musical talents, but this is another side of Zach Carter that I didn't know existed.
Yeah. Howie had a very serious career in the music industry.
That's when we met. I used to do radio. I did music radio in Los Angeles. I was on the air at a really, really good radio station when Howie was president of Reprise Records. So that's how we know each other from a prior life. Yes.
My goodness. No. Yeah. I played in rock and roll. That was my job. I got into journalism and writing for the money, because the money in music was so bad. But I played in a band called Cataract Camp that had a record produced by Travis Morrison from Dismemberment Plan, for anybody who's interested. And I had a band called Drunk Tigers that sounded like The Replacements, and that band Brutalism, we made electronic music in that one. It was fun.
Are you doing any music now?
I play a lot of children's songs for a 2-year-old.
I know that feeling. Well, my 2-year-old all of a sudden is 22, so it goes by really quickly. Anyway, Zach Carter, it's great to talk to you. I'm sorry it's been so long. I thoroughly enjoy these conversations. A lot of it is way over my head, but you make it easy to understand. I encourage people to check out the book. It's available in paperback now, The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. And check out your Substack as well, ZacharyDCarter.substack.com. I'll put links to everything on the blog at NicoleSandler.com. Thank you so much. It was great talking to you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Nicole.
That was, again, Zachary D. Carter. Fun, right? I told you the interview went a long time because it was fascinating. And that's the thing. When I pre-record interviews, I'm not, you know, I don't start at the bottom of the hour. So I have a 30-minute limit to get to the top of the hour. If they have time and I have time, we can keep going if it's an interesting conversation like I think that one was. So hope you enjoyed it. I got a lot out of it. I really like Zach. Check out his Substack and the book if, you know, economics is your thing. But who knew I'd like, the deficit myth? Or I just got Zach's book, so I need to read that as well. All right, with that, we're done. Quick note, because actually I've got about a minute. My artwork that you see behind me is for sale. I switched around the pictures because somebody yesterday said, can I see the seascape that's on the other side where the brown dog is? The brown dog is Jackson, by the way. So I traded them. See, there's Jackson for those of you watching on video. Jackson and Sandy in the middle and the seascape. So somebody wanted to see it yesterday. So I said I would switch them for you. It's all for sale. And yes, I do commissions. I do pet portraits. I just tried a horse, a woman on a horse. The horse came out great. The woman, not so much, because I can't do human faces yet. But I'm working on it. So, you know, it's another way you can support the show, support my artwork. If you're interested in anything, just shoot me an email. Or if you just want to comment on the show, you can too. Nicole@NicoleSandler.com, and I do answer most of them. I read it all. I answer most. All right. Thank you, everybody. Tomorrow, Howie Klein, and the latest on what's happening in D.C. So we got that going for us, too. All right. Thanks for listening. Bye. All right. I let that play out because, you know, I edit that. That's when the show ends on the Progressive Voices Network. I never have any idea really when they cut me off because our clocks are not synced up. But that's besides the fact. That also goes in the archives, and Progressive Voices plays, I think, 4 episodes on the weekends, 2 on Saturdays and 2 on Sundays. But I have to have them time out to 60 minutes so it fits in the slot. So that's why I let the show end and then I come back and say, all right, we'll end with the news. So, God, thank you so much for listening, everybody. And just so you know, we were having a little conversation in the YouTube chat room while the interview was playing because it's, you know, when I have things on tape, I can participate in the chat. Anyway, we were talking about the fact that, you know, we don't have a whole lot of listeners to this program. And one of the things, I'm just not doing enough in terms of promoting. What we need to do is cut clips from the show, like 5 to 10 minute long clips or even shorter, you know, one question from each particular interview and post it as a standalone, something that's entertaining on its own, but that will help promote the show. So, but I don't have a producer or anything. So if you guys hear, as in the course of your regular listening, you hear and you go, that was a great question and answer. Like that was a really good segment that you think could be excerpted. Send it to me. Tell me either it was, you know, on Tuesday from 5:15 to 5:20 or whatever. If you're watching on YouTube, if you have a more exact timestamp, that's great. Tell me when it was. That's all you need to do. I'll go through it and pull it. I just don't have the time to go back and listen to all the shows to pull the clips that I think are good. And as I was telling our friends in the chat, I don't remember half of what goes on during the show. I'll finish the show and sometimes not, like, I can tell you who I spoke to, but I couldn't tell you what we talked about. It's weird. You get in kind of a zone. Other people who, you know, have done radio for a long time, I guess, have the same thing, but whatever. So I could use your help. So if you're listening and you think this would make a good clip, write down the time, email it to me, and then I'll pull it and post it. That's the easy part. Okay. I guess that's it. I know I need a Sean or someone like him. Yeah, I do. But yeah, I don't have money to pay them. I don't have money to pay me. So I certainly don't have money to pay anyone else. And I don't want to ask anybody to work for free. So, you know, so I do it all myself. Okay. I guess I'll leave you with the news. Tomorrow, Thursday, we got the first half hour to ourselves to do whatever. And then, you know, Howie Klein will be here at the bottom of the hour for the rest of the time. I want to share with you a tweet he just sent out. Okay. Very quickly. Howie just tweeted, "Why didn't anyone think of this before? Alan Grayson said, quote, we must bust the filibuster. And if I'm elected to the Senate, I will do that by filibustering it. Specifically, I will filibuster the adoption of the Senate rules unless those rules eliminate the filibuster." Okay. I guess he's talking about a talking filibuster, which is the only kind of filibuster that should be allowed anymore. because he can't single-handedly do the kind of filibuster that the Republicans do. So just saying. But it's a good idea. If he's and knowing Grayson, he's willing to do the standing filibuster. We'll see. Hopefully they get rid of the filibuster before the next elections. All right. Okay. Now I will say I'll see you tomorrow and I'll leave you with the news. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
D.C. Hell Week continues with no apparent progress on a number of fronts. Government funding runs out at the end of the day on Thursday, setting up the possibility of a Friday shutdown. The Senate is expected to vote possibly today on a revamped clean spending bill that would fund the government through December 3rd, but doesn't include raising the debt limit. The House will take up the bill if and when it clears the Senate. As for the debt ceiling, Mitch McConnell has made it crystal clear that the Republicans are willing to let the nation default, causing catastrophic economic disaster and destroying the good faith and credit of the U.S. So Democrats are exploring how they could raise the debt ceiling without any help from the traitors. The only avenue seemed to be by changing the filibuster rule, either eliminating it entirely or carving out an exception in order to save the nation from default. The other option? Using budget reconciliation, which only requires 50 votes plus one. But doing anything about the filibuster appears to be a non-starter, as President Biden, on Tuesday, explicitly ruled out that option.
Come on, man.
But on Wednesday morning, Chuck Schumer said Congress can't use reconciliation to raise the debt limit, calling it uncharted waters. NBC News' Sahil Kapoor reporting Senate Democrats are categorically ruling out using reconciliation to lift the debt limit. The bottom line from Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, the federal government will run out of ways to avoid a catastrophic federal debt default by October 18th if Congress won't raise the debt ceiling. Economists say a default would send financial markets plunging and delay payments to millions of Americans. Yellen also warned that the deadline could come even earlier. Yellen wrote, "This uncertainty underscores the critical importance of not waiting to raise or suspend the debt limit. The full faith and credit of the United States should not be put at risk." And still, Senate Republicans have said they will not provide a single vote to raise the debt ceiling. Stay tuned. Now on to the two spending bills that are crucial parts of President Biden's economic and social agenda. Many in the Congressional Progressive Caucus have reiterated that they will vote against the smaller, so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill that is coming up for a vote on Thursday, because the bigger, more comprehensive Build Back Better Act, the $3.5 trillion spending package over 10 years that was already agreed would be brought in tandem with the smaller bill, is still being negotiated. Holding everything up are the two senators, Manchin and Sinema, who were again at the White House on Tuesday, but reportedly still refused to even give a top line number they'd be happy with. Democrats need all 50 of those Senate votes in the evenly split chamber to push through the legislation. Again, stay tuned and tighten that buckle. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, defended the withdrawal of the last U.S. forces from Afghanistan last month in a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing on Tuesday, though he did acknowledge that the process didn't go according to plan. He said that the operation was a, quote, logistical success, but a strategic failure. General Milley, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, and the head of U.S. Central Command, General Frank McKenzie, will testify on Wednesday before the House Armed Services Committee. Fumio Kishida, Japan's former foreign minister, won a runoff election for leadership of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party's leadership on Wednesday, pretty much guaranteeing he'll be Japan's next prime minister. In the ongoing battle against vaccine disinformation, YouTube has announced that they are taking down a few video channels associated with high-profile anti-vaccine activists, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr. It's part of a new set of policies aimed at cutting down on anti-vaccine content. So YouTube says they'll ban any videos that claim that commonly used vaccines approved by health authorities are ineffective or dangerous. YouTube had previously blocked videos that made those claims about coronavirus vaccines, but not for other vaccines, such as those for measles or chickenpox. That's a step in the right direction anyway. A bit of encouraging news on the COVID front. For the first time since June, a CDC forecast projects new COVID-19 deaths are likely to decrease over the next 4 weeks. Hey, we got to take the little victories wherever we can get them these days. And finally, a Maryland judge on Tuesday sentenced Jared Ramos to 5 life sentences without parole for fatally shooting 5 people at the Capitol Gazette newsroom in 2018. A jury in July rejected Ramos' insanity plea and found him guilty on murder, assault, and other charges connected to the killings. The victims included Rob Hiasen, the newspaper's deputy editor, and the brother
of National Treasure. And that's just a bit of what's news,
one of my favorite authors, Carl Hiasen. If you appreciate these reports others. And the Nicole Sandler
judge.
Show.
Sorry. Whoops. I fixed it, but I get
supported, and cruel and disregard for the help. Sanctity of human
Find
life.
Find out more at NicoleSandler.com.
I did fix it, and the wrong one is playing again.
I'm sorry about that. Oh, boy. All right. We're done. I'll see you tomorrow, everyone. Bye.